So, of course, I will not be able to cover all what I've prepared, so in Google. And so I will stop at some point. Now, it will also depend as usual on how much you have any questions and interest in the meetings or things discussing. So, before in this week, there will be some specialized talks, I guess. He's from the experts, from Sergei. I was trying to give more an overview of the status of how we can treat and how far we can treat atoms and polymerization molecules in intense ultrasound laser pulses. So what has been done? And of course the question would be in this virtual one, there's any way to bridge from all the work we have been doing in the long wavelengths to the short wavelengths, okay? And there was once a nice article in the Journal of Irreproducible Results. I don't know if this journal still exists. And there was the title of the work was On the Influence of Peanut Butter on the Earth's Rotation. And there was a long author list, as we now know also from FEM experiments in IMO physics. And then there was a single sentence, we couldn't find any influence of peanut butter on the rotation of Earth. And in a certain sense, of course, there's a risk that all what I tell you cannot be transferred to the short wavelength. Okay.
Questo. Ok. Ok.
Please start again.
This was off the record, you know. Ok. So, we have heard about the different regimes. And before I, so to speak, I mean, it's really worthwhile to consider it, although it has been considered quite some oft, so I will not go too much into details. Just put it in my way of perspective of this, what I'm discussing here. So I will leave out, in contrast to Alfred, the relativistic constraints and the complications there. And just the idea is then that you put here the field strength, the electric field strength of the laser pulse, the maximum of it, divided by square root of 2 times the ionization potential or binding energy of your electron. And here we have the photon energy scaled again by the binding energy or ionization potential of your system. And so this means that, for example, if you have a value of 1 here, that you need 1 photon to overcome the ionization threshold. But if you have a value of 0.5, you need 2 photons and so on. So this axis could also be labeled in this direction as the number of photons you need to ionize. Okay, now as we have heard, there's a famous work by Kaldish, and everyone uses somehow, at least the experimentalists heavily use it, the argument that you have this Kaldish parameter which separates in this plane the multiphoton from the quasi-static approximation, as I would call it. And I really agree to Robin that I think it's better to call it adiabatic or quasi-static, because really you have a separation here of this range in the so-called tunneling. And the over the barrier or barrier suppression ionization. And this is separated by the classical over the barrier threshold, which is IP square over fior in a simple treatment for the hydrogenic type of approximation. As I said, this is gamma Keldysh, which in this way here we may write as omega over F scaled by 2 square root IP. You see, I choose this way of writing it to be somehow conform with this type of how I define the field strength. And of course, this line, this demarcation line, is formally when the Keldysh parameter is 1. Of course, it's an approximation. We have simplified pictures here in mind. So you shouldn't believe that there's a sharp transition from here to here. But in fact, you only say that if you are on this side far away or sufficiently far away from this demarcation line, you assume multiphoton ionization. And here you assume quasi-static picture to give you some idea.
Can you define perturbative region from non-perturbative on this diagram?
Did you know what I have in my...
Oh.
Okay, so yes, of course. So here we have the lowest order perturbation theory. Thank you. Of course, I should stay in conform. So it's of course a subpart of the multiphoton regime. And so lowest order perturbation theory should be roughly valid here. And this is if, oops, F over 2, oops, square root IP is roughly, if there's something unclear, please ask, is roughly proportional to h bar omega and square root h bar omega of IP. This is one way to make an estimate of its validity. We have heard other justifications or not. It just give a rough idea where we could expect its validity. And now, when everything should be hopefully complete, of course, the next question is there any reality in these pictures? Do they show up in some real world type of results? So this is now photoelectron spectra, energy resolved electron spectra from a full TDSE calculation of the hydrogen atom, so the simplest possible case. So for different wavelengths, this is for 400 nanometer, 800 nanometer, 1600 nanometers. And considering the binding or ionization potential of hydrogen atom or the electron and hydrogen atoms, 13.6 eV, it means that if we have 400 nanometer wavelengths, 3.1 eV, so we need 5 photons to reach the ionization. Here we need 9 photons at least, and here we need at least 18 photons. So this is the number of photons where we, so to speak, start, and then we have here scaled the electron energy in the units of photon energies. So we see here what we have been discussing before, the above threshold ionization peaks. Now when you consider here, every graph has two curves. The black one is 2 times 10 to the 13 watt per square centimeter peak intensity. The red one is 2 times 10 to the 13 and 1 times 14. 10 to the 14, so 5 times higher peak intensity. So if you now go...
Alejandro?
Yes?
Can I ask with respect to the ionization potential of hydrogen, how, so 3.2, the usual thing that we know, UP, how does it relate to the intensity that you have, so that I can get a feeling?
Oh, I didn't put UP here, but I don't want to go into the details here because I just want to discuss here the basic concept.
No, yeah? Fine,
but of course, here, as you should see, here you do not see any peaks except clearly separated. So the first one is exactly there where you would expect. So you don't see any effect of UP, for example, here. But of course, here you cannot resolve these things any longer. But this is basically what I want to show here.
you're cheating.
I'm cheating, of course, yes.
So you're not scaling the length of a pulse.
Yes.
So your final simulation is single cycle.
Yes. I can assure you we have done it also for longer.
Three cycle or four cycles,
yes.
You will see the ETI progression. Yes.
Yeah, but not fully either. You will also see the interference patterns.
Yeah, of course.
Still. So this is why I keep it here this way. We have also compared it with the same cycle length. But of course. As I said, it's much too, I don't want to go here into the details. I just wanted to show that what you see here is the nice progression of well-defined ATI peaks. Remind, this is a logarithmic scale from 10 to the minus 16 to 1. Yeah? So you really see, I mean, in an experiment, you would basically see the first peak, and if you have a good resolution, maybe the second or the third, but you see it goes down from here to here by two orders of magnitudes, the peak maximum, and of course, the contrast is extremely high. So in between, you would not see anything, and you would really say you have nice resolved ATI peaks. If you crank up the intensity, you still see well-defined peaks, but you start to see structure, substructure coming in, and you also see the shift of the peaks, or the peak maxima. And this is, as you would expect from this picture, yeah, if you go up in the intensity, you go up this line, yeah, so for a given number of photons you need, you go up into this line, and so if you can be, are able to go high enough without blowing up your system, you should see, according to this simple picture, the trend to going to the quasi-static picture. Now, of course, 400 nanometers is still very tough, so you can go to 800 nanometers. Again, for the lower intensities, you see the peaks, but you see, of course, the slope already is not as fast decaying as here. And you get also here some substructures, not as pronounced as here, but you see that. And then if you go in high end intensity, you get a rather diffuse picture with interferences coming in. Yeah? And then finally, if you go now to the 1600 nanometers with the concerns of Sergei, but even if you have the ATIs resolved, they are still on a very small scale here. Yeah? The key point is that you somehow kind of see an exponential decay with different slope. So this is just to tell you that in these pictures, there is something which you find in the spectrum. Yeah? But when, nevertheless, one has to be very careful, it's simple pictures. Yeah, and of course the physics is always doesn't know about whether you are here or here. Yeah. And especially the word multiphoton is of course a little bit critical by itself because
Alejandro,
yeah?
What is simple about it? I mean you are doing, you say a solution, efficient solution of the time dependent Schrödinger equation.
Mm-hmm.
So
no, not the calculation is simple, but so, the interpretation.
Ah.
Yeah, it's just the interpretation, the pictures here, I want to be alerting. Not, I hope not that this is supposed to be simple, yes. Okay, so now if we go through this diagram, we can look for the different approaches and use the simplifications given here in the diagram. So the first approach would be, so if we go to, this was introduction, so now to the second part. Theoretical approaches. Then we can learn from this that, of course, one of the attempts we can do is to use low-order perturbation theory. Yeah? And we have been hearing a little, or quite something about it. Of course, the key point here is that you assume that you can partition your Hamiltonian in some time-independent part, the free atom molecule, and so on, and some time-dependent perturbation, V of t. And I remind, and this was what I said with the picture of the multiphoton picture, I remind that, of course, you get this energy conservation of the final step, from the initial to the final step, only in the long time limit. Yeah, if of a long, in principle, infinite perturbation. And otherwise, of course, you have your delta type, instead of a delta function energy, you have a sinus x over x type of behavior, or it's square if you consider the probabilities. So in reality, of course, Yes. But probably it's anyhow, you cannot see it because of this. So, yeah? So for a non-infinite perturbation, your rate should be in principle proportional to the sinus x over x square behavior. So only in the long term or time limit, you really observe your energy conservation. And therefore, you would get by order, your peak, ATI peak, and so on. Yeah? And of course, here what you see, the width is of course due to the finite pulse width of your of the laser pulse simulated here. Yeah? Okay. We have already heard that the calculation of LOPT is non-trivial. So, you have your long-term expression, which I may not write here fully, but you know it's over all the possible intermediate states from nu, mu, and so on, from the initial state to the final state. Yeah, you can write it with a Green's function. I think I have it on overhead if you want to have it. Just to tell you that it's really not that trivial for some reasons, or you can, I mean, if you want to take this as an argument, is that here, I mean, in 99, you have already heard about it, we have tried to do really quantitative, there's two methods comparing quantitative 2-, 3-, and 4-fold ionization cross sections of helium using Lowe's order perturbation theory, as a contracted work, as Peter called it. Then in 2000 with Amalia, we did H2 plus with an arbitrary orientation and considering the nuclear distance dependence. And then in 2002, H2 fully correlated. And the key point is just to give you an example how these expressions explode for a molecule. This is just the 2-photon Lowe's order perturbation theory cross-section for an arbitrarily oriented molecule. Yeah, this is all the terms which show up considering the symmetry of a diatomic molecule. Yeah, so because you have now interferences between these amplitudes, you have to take all these terms into account. So you can easily imagine what it means if you go to 3-photon, 4-photon, 5-photon, etc. You may remember that for the 1-photon, it's just 1/3 plus 2/3 parallel to perpendicular. Yes?
So for a 2-photon process, in principle, we have just a sum over a set of intermediate states.
Yes.
So somehow, the reason we get so many terms here is because you somehow introduce labels for the intermediate states. Since I can't read it.
Sorry, yeah. It's just to show. Yeah. It's the point is that you want to use symmetry, usually. So this is if you go from sigma g to sigma g and sigma wire sigma u or wire pi wire and so on, intermediate states. So of course you can say the simple-minded approach if you don't use symmetry. So for a very complicated molecule, or say much more complicated than H2, of course you can say it doesn't appear because you don't have symmetry. Yeah, then it's just. But of course what it shows you is what internally happens. How the expression explodes. Because of course internally in the partial waves, this is of course has to be included in your set of intermediate states. And has to be represented properly in your basis. Yeah. So in that sense, it's a non-trivial problem. But of course, I agree that the terms get easier if you don't consider symmetry. That's a funny thing. Yeah. Okay. And we, yeah.
The metric questions, are those intermediate states only bound states?
Or? No, this is a problem. You have to sum over the whole spectrum of bound and continuum states.
And are they energy?
They're not energy conserving. Only the first to last step. So there's one delta function, so to speak, in the end, which is not here, yeah, which is for the from the initial to the final state with the number of photons, in this case, two.
And are the energy denominators a problem then?
Yes. If you if there wouldn't be a problem, of course you would use closure over the intermediate states, and then you would be done very quickly. Yeah, this is one of the approximations people have been doing in the old times to try to get handle at least something. So include some states explicitly, and then to do closure over the remaining, subtracting what you have included, etc. So there are many types of approaches. Yeah. Now, again. The question is, how does it perform? And this is now an example for H2, Lowe's auto perturbation theory, now comparing to a full TDSE calculator. This is just Lowe's auto perturbation theory. Next slide will be with TDSE. So for different photon energies and different cycles. And so what you see here, as you expect from Lowe's auto perturbation theory, your rate, your n photon rate, should be proportional to this n photon cross section times intensity to the power of n. We have heard this. And this is just a numerical cross check whether you see something like this. And you see here that if you need two photons, you really get a very nice slope of 2. So the purple line is a fit with slope 2. For three photons, you find 2.93. For four photons, we find 3.88. And we find this systematically, whatever system we look at, that the slope does not really remain, so to speak, exactly 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. But it has the tendency to be lower. Yeah. And actually, this is also seen in some of the experiments. So. I don't really understand why it's always linear, but a smaller slope. Yeah, I mean, of course, there are some arguments why it could change the slope due to the finite widths, etc. But it's a little bit unclear why it, so to speak, nicely gives a linear curve. But Peter, maybe.
Well, proximity of intermediate states to one of the photons would tend to lower the slope.
Yes. And I guess the point is that as more photons you involve, as larger is the probability to get the proximity.
Right.
Yes.
And if you have, of course, there is a bandwidth associated
yes.
with the pulse, so the tail can.
Yes. We consider this and change with Gaussians and cosine square and so on. The point is that. As I said, it happens already in the Lowe's auto perturbation. I mean, in the if you take the yields, I'm not completely sure why, but yeah.
Sorry. Does the slope change with the pulse duration?
This we checked. It's not really. I mean, it changes sometimes a little bit, but it's not this general trend is rather common. Yes.
So now I must confess I'm very confused. So you say you use Lowe's auto perturbation theory. You have an expression for a gamma.
No, sorry, I mixed you up. I admit now. Sorry. This is TDSE. Sorry. The next one is Lowe's auto perturbation. This is TDSE confirming the trend of Lowe's auto perturbation theory. I'm sorry. Yes, you were completely right. Yeah. So this is full TDSE calculation, and the slopes we get. From my argument, it should have been indirectly clear, but
what's the wavelength?
The wavelength is here. It's large.
Okay.
So it's a simple process. As I said, it should be, the idea is that you check Lowe's auto perturbation theory by assuming that you should find this. Yeah, and of course, if you use Lowe's auto perturbation theory, you always find it, but in practice, in the TDSE, you do not find, or we don't find it, for whatever system we have considered so far.
If you want to run your TDSE at 3/4 of 13.6 eV, wavelength.
three quarters.
Yes.
Why do you want to have this? We want to have resonance.
Yes.
I know, but we have checked that this is not a resonance effect. We know that the slope depends, of course, if you have a resonance, if you have a proximity. We have gone really through a lot of series of calculations on hydrogen atom to make really big. We have made a group internal web-based data bank on hydrogen calculations. Yeah, so we have ATI spectra and rates, etc., in a big data bank. Yeah, so we have done a lot of calculations and we really tried it systematically.
If one suspects that some state might be playing a role because of its proximity to the wavelength, then the thing to do is just change the wavelength.
We did, this is what I just said, we did a big scan of wavelengths, of pulse forms, pulse durations, and we always find this trend. The funny thing is it's always linear when it is in this regime, but the slope is smaller than the number of photons you need. That's a general trend. So I can understand immediately why the slope is not perfect. What we failed to find an explanation for is why it's linear still. I mean, we see, of course, for near resonance, you get a curvy behavior and whatever, but we couldn't find a reason why it's, in a very good approximation linear if there's no resonance involved.
Don't you expect perturbation theory to be something like an asymptotic series? So for sufficiently low intensities, don't you expect to get the exact same slope as perturbation theory predicts?
We expect, but as I said, it's a matter of the pulse shape also, or the decay of the pulse in reality, even if you take a Gaussian pulse. Yeah, and we see this influence. So if you go from a cosine square to a Gaussian, it's extreme, the difference. But if you look in the details, but we cannot, as I said, we couldn't come up with an explanation why it's linear but slow, lower.
What you see is different than the details of the pulse.
Exactly. But we couldn't converge to anything with whatever pulse we tried to get the slope properly. This is what I have to say. Okay.
Just one question.
Yes.
Could it be that the intensity region is a little bit narrow? I mean, over a narrow, in a sense, a narrow intensity region, the slope will always seem constant.
But would you think this is a narrow range?
No, but just looking at the last one, the 3.88 one, the green one is in a sense, a relatively narrow.
Almost two orders of magnitude.
Yeah, but you see, if you go down, if the probability eventually is 10 to minus 20 or less,
yeah.
And you reach that at a
we tried this and
the slope at some point should indeed converge to 4%.
Yes. But there the shape is very important. But the question is why, there is another, so to speak, peak of if you take a cosine square pulse, for example, you really get for low intensities to a slope 1 actually. Always. If you take a Gaussian pulse, it's not. Yeah. So this is what I'm saying. Maybe if you take really the limit of an infinite pulse without dismantling everything, which is your problem, your curse. Yeah.
But this is the problem with the time-dependent calculation.
Yes.
Okay. Always. There is this uncertainty.
Yes. The interesting thing was that I spoke to some experimentalists, and they normally confirm this behavior. For funny reasons. Yeah, also as Max Born and so on, they say they also see this.
And Alejandro, did you try with a trapeze pulse?
Yes, this is to get rates, yes, this helps. But this, of course, as I said, if you make it imperfect, you see that there are, of course, trouble with it. I mean, we don't take a trapeze finally, we take a Gaussian turn on. Constant and Gaussian turn off.
Yes. And you find the same slope.
We not exactly the same, but we find not the perfect slope. But I think the point is really you would have to go to infinite conditions where you have a problem, maybe. So maybe it's just a problem of the TDSE in practice, or to find a pulse which really fulfills the perfect lowest order perturbation conditions.
Okay. But if that is true, you should be able to get it analytically. If that's a true slope, and is it you see it only for H2 or?
No, we see it for different systems.
How sensitive are the slopes that you see to the pulse parameters?
Sorry?
You see these slopes, how sensitive, I mean, do these slopes that you see, do they change if you change the pulse shape?
Slightly, this is what I said, yes. Yeah. And as I said, it can be extreme, as I said, for low intensities, but you want really to go down with a cosine square, you will find the funny thing that they all go to slope 1. Yeah, whatever you do.
Fine.
But with a Gaussian, this does disappear. Yeah?
Finally, in H2 plus, you have the same phenomenon.
Sorry?
In H2 plus, you have the same phenomenon.
I think so. I'm not completely sure we tried hydrogen, helium, H2, I think also H2 plus, but they are not completely sure whether we really check this on H2 plus. And H2 we find the same.
No, in helium.
In hydrogen atom and helium we find the same, yeah. This is what I said. We went to hydrogen atom. Sorry?
Alejandro, where are you? You have this curve which makes a difference between the LOPT and the multiphoton. Are you not approaching too close to this curve?
No. And on the one end, yeah. But the point is that the slope is even for lower intensities where you shouldn't be on this end. Yeah.
So you get the same slope, for example, if you look
yes.
at the 3 for the 4 photon,
yes.
you get exactly the same slope at the beginning or
yes.
the end.
Yeah, not at the very beginning, of course, but this is what I said.
You don't see, for example, the slope higher for...
No, we have checked that we are not too high in intensity. This is what...
Alejandro, in addition to proximity of intermediate states, you have stark shifts taking place.
Yes. 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 This is what I'm saying. But what I find funny is that it's always slope a linear on the exponential type of thing, and not mixing up completely.
At these frequencies, the stark shifts are small.
Yes.
Small.
Yeah. At these frequencies.
If you go especially to the lower intensity side.
10 eV, it's small.
Yeah, but the intensity. And these are not, I'm not talking about the locomotive shift.
I'm talking about AC
shift. Yeah, which is influenced by the distance between states.
Yeah.
Okay.
I apologize. I really don't know your work, and I don't know what initial wave function you are using in this sort of calculation. Simple approximation.
No.
Or do you have an actual quantum
Mari-Powell wave function? No, it's a full CI wave function. I come to this.
Okay.
If probably not, but I wanted to come to this. Okay. So now this is now the direct comparison I had in mind, so to speak, how I confused you. This is the first TDSE calculation. Now we have a much denser grid from about 5 years ago, a full TDSE calculation of H2, and it's not this what I want to focus on. I want to focus the comparison here. This is 10 to the 12 watts per square centimeter, cosine square pulse 15 femtoseconds. And the energy dependence, photon frequency dependence. This is the expression you have to calculate in lowest order perturbation theory, and now red is lowest order perturbation theory, one photon. Green is two photon lowest order perturbation theory. And so on. So blue is 3 photon, and purple is 4 photon. Now, in the meantime, we would not scale it this way, we would scale it here by wavelengths to make the different photon regimes similar size. But it should just give you again an impression that, these things, this picture has a meaning, and also actually that this condition is not so strict, because the perturbative regime does not stop suddenly, but again, of course, it smoothly deviates from the full TDSE. Yeah, now, of course, what we have been discussing is that you have these very sharp peaks, and they come, of course, because we use here lowest order perturbation theory with the delta function for an infinite perturbation, sort of formally, and therefore, of course, we resolve the resonances, the ramp peaks, step by step. So this is, if you want to understand the spectrum, then, of course, what you see here is ionization is a black curve, and red is ionization plus excitation of bound states. And you see now that these peaks can be attributed to resonantly enhanced multiphoton ionization, via the B state, via the B prime state. In the one photon window, the EF state, sigma G, sigma U, sigma G, in the two photon window, and so on. Yeah. So you can attribute this, and you understand how these things come in. So one photon, two photon, three photon, and so on. And you can also look at the photoelectron spectra. And of course, in lowest order perturbation theory, in its simple form, you would just get one photoelectron peak. Yeah. And this is now the TDSE results. And what you see for 2 times 10 to the 12 and 2 times 10 to the 13, it's resolved, the photoelectron spectra, this functional energy of the electron, by sigma gerade and sigma ungerade, total finite 2 electron states. Yeah. And what you see is, of course, that you have still a very good dipole selection rule. So you have here going to the ungerade, to the gerade, ungerade, and so on. But you see, of course, because you are, it's a full TDSE, non-perturbative, you see contributions where you wouldn't expect them from simple dipole selection rule. But because of the strong field, of course, it's not any longer fully valid. But of course, you also see that this is still orders of magnitude smaller. So the dominant contribution is still well understandable. OK. So bottom line, what are the challenges? The challenges is to obtain a complete set of intermediate states. If you want to, even if you want to do low order perturbation theory, it's non-trivial. It sounds always, oh, this is just perturbation theory. But if you want to do it for something less simple than hydrogen atom, where we know that you can do this Lewis-Zargano and so on, special tricks because of this speciality of the Coulomb, the pure Coulomb potential, then this is an issue. And as I said, it has mostly, I mean, for ionization, not for small photon bound-to-bound transitions, it has basically only done up to H2. Yeah? And I showed you the references. It's not really long time ago that this has been achieved. Yeah? Okay, there was also the inclusion of nuclear motion in low order perturbation theory for 2, 3, 4 photon processes by Fernando Martin and co-workers, I mean Alicia Palacios, Henri Bachot, and Fernando Martin. Okay, now this was the simplest way for coming from here. Now the next simple way would be to approach the problem from the quasi-static model. And again, things sound rather simple. What you do is that you try to realize the idea that your quasi-static rate should be basically a pulse period or pulse cycle averaged integral over the static rate as a function of the field, which now, of course, during the pulse, one cycle changes. Yeah? So f of t.
Before you move on to that, I'm sorry. Yes. I'm always behind you because you mentioned the EF state, for example, in H2.
Yes.
This dissociates to the angle 2 limit. There's a nest of 6 of them in there, 6 pi's and 6 sigmas. When you go to n equal 3, gets extremely complicated in there, and then n equal 4, and they all start to sit down.
Yes, this is why Fernando Martin did it on a supercomputer.
You're telling me you did all those states with?
No, I said Fernando Martin. Fernando Martin and co-workers did in a heroic work until 4 photon, including within the Born-Oppenheimer approximation for parallel orientation. They did the perturbative calculation. Using a full CI expansion for the two electrons.
The implication here is you're saying you have to get the full spectroscopy correct.
Yes.
Of any molecule to estimate the 1-2 n photon.
You get the point, yes. Yes.
That the community is adopting.
This is what is the attempt, yeah. It's not really that anyone else except Fernando Martin has done it, really. We have done a little bit in this alliance, but not really of this type. And so this is exactly what I try to say. It's 2006, I think, was the paper.
I don't think they need the full spectroscopy, right? You basically need the Green's function within a finite volume. Right?
Yes.
So you can have a spectral representation in terms of discrete states, which I believe is what Martin does.
Yes. But of course, you have to get spectroscopic accuracy if you want to get the resonance. It's fine, correct?
View.
Yeah. I mean, the point is to select those states. This is what I try to say with the challenges. Yeah. And maybe I should really say achieved up to at most H2. This is maybe what I wanted to make sure that actually my point was it is really difficult. It's not trivial to do low order perturbation theory for a complicated molecule. Okay. So. So this would be now the quasi-static concept. And again, it sounds, or maybe sounding rather straightforward, because for hydrogen atom, you know how to calculate the static rate, I mean the ionization rate of hydrogen atom in a static DC field. Yeah. And again, because of the peculiarities of Coulomb, and maybe because people have spent enough time for that, you know how to solve it, yeah, in different ways. And now the point here is, however, if you want to go beyond hydrogen atom, again, it's a non-trivial task to get these static ionization rates. Yeah. So the problem is gamma static beyond the H atom. Yes?
But, I mean, at least for atoms, it's relatively straightforward to use Bounce techniques if one does something like complex scaling.
Yes.
So one can formulate it in a way that's more or less a bound excited state type calculation for an atom. In principle, that also works for molecules, but there's a basis set problem typically.
Exactly.
So is that the point you're worried about, the basis set issue for molecules?
Yeah. And also for atoms, I didn't really see too many successful calculations of this type. I mean, to treat the many electron problem properly with complex scaling is also non-trivial. Actually, long, long time ago, I was discussing this issue with Thomas Sommerfeld from Heidelberg, and we did some preliminary calculations on that. And I mean, there we used CUP, and the complex absorbing potential, but it was really too much depending on the potential you used. Yeah, so we didn't really pursue this further. I don't want to say it doesn't work, but I just say that, I mean, at least 10 years ago, we were not so happy with that. Okay? So, this would be, again, the latest point I wanted to do. The first point people are doing is they use simplified models. They try to extend the hydrogen result, and this is PPT, Paralomov, Popov, Terentov, or which for funny reasons, I mean, there's a bad concept why, the much more popular ADK, Amosov, Dillon, Krinov formula. One should make clear that the key point of the key difference here of this, which was earlier, in this is two aspects. One is the way how you generalize the quantum numbers to effective quantum numbers, N star, L star. And the other thing is, maybe this is the reason why it's so most liked by the experimentalists, they introduced the Stirling approximation for the factorials. Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, it's certainly not necessary with nowadays computers, but at that time, when it was introduced, probably helpful and very popular. Yeah, so mostly you find people discussing ADK, but one should not forget that PPT is in principle, the preliminary step in showing for the way how it works. And actually, our experience is that PPT is better than ADK in practice. Yeah, especially what is almost completely forgotten, it seems, the frequency corrected PPT. It's really good, surprisingly good. Okay, so yeah, so basically the idea is that you use, so to speak, or introduce an effective N and L. And of course, what in Perelomov Popov-Tarantov's work was done is exactly the calculation of this integral with the corresponding quasi-static formula then. Okay.
Yeah. Something about correcting for frequency, is that so?
Yes.
And that's the PPT one.
I just made a side remark that in the PPT work, they also discussed a frequency correction to the tunneling formula. So of course, beyond the tunneling or quasi-static picture.
Can I ask for what kind of range of frequencies you would need to correct for frequency?
Depends on your problem. I mean, it depends on where you are here. Yeah. In this scheme. But this is exactly what you have to investigate carefully. Yeah?
Because these days you probably use Udin Ivanov as like the
subcycle.
Yes.
Can you say for the non-experts what is frequency correction?
Yes.
The point is that what we have here is a static rate, and we introduce here only that f of t goes like a sinus omega t. Yeah? And so then we average over that. But of course, in principle, you cannot expect that there's one formula which is derived in principle for this limit should work forever here. So the idea is whether you can make a correction to it to include somehow the frequency. And this is what PPT did. Actually, yeah, it's a little bit differently made, and the formula is relatively simple, actually, which they get out. Yeah, I just made the side remark because it seems to be almost forgotten for unfortunate reasons. Because it's,
give us the reference to that, because I didn't know.
Unfortunately, I don't have it here, but I can give it to you. Okay. Yes.
I mean, maybe this is again becoming clear if one realizes what quasi-static means. Right? It really means it's an adiabatic picture and. There is actually no omega dependence at the end of the
day.
So that's why you need a frequency correction to take into consideration.
Yes, that's why I asked you. I asked Alejandro, for what range of frequencies it's okay to go with ADK?
I cannot answer such a general question with a general answer. This was my answer. Yeah.
Usually for PPT, you think of it as you're entering the barrier at a complex time. And so that sine of omega t has a different intensity because of t is complex. And so I think the PPT just works in a complex time and probably isn't a quasi-static theory at all.
But it's not a question, I think. Because I think Agapi wanted to have a recipe, you know, a number. Okay. So there was an extension then proposed to molecules by Tong and Zhidong Lin and others in PRI 66. Maybe I give the reference now. 033402, 2002. Although you can get the references from me if you're interested. Where the idea is rather simple. What you say is, okay, you take your molecule, you calculate molecular wave function, the ground state, yeah, or the initial state to be more accurate, and then you fit the long range part of your wave function, which should be responsible for tunneling or whatever. So the long range part of your wave function you fit to hydrogen-like functions. Yeah? And then you take the standard ADK for these different components. Of course, now we have a superposition, a Korean superposition of these, a hydrodynamic wave function, but this is the idea. Yeah. So fit asymptotic molecular wave function to H-like orbitals or wave functions and use hydrogen-like ADK. Okay, so actually if you look into detailed into this, you find out that this is not so trivial as it sounds, because actually you will never find a real range where you have this asymptotic behavior of your molecular wave function really well represented by a hydrogen one. And especially if you use a quantum chemistry code in its standard way, yeah, then of course you use Gaussians in 99% of the cases nowadays. And Gaussians have the wrong short and long range behavior. So you need a lot of them to get a proper exponentially decaying function. And therefore, it depends crucially how you perform your fit. And actually, just recently, the authors of this paper, I mean, Chidong Lin and so on, were making a paper where they reconsidered all their molecules because they found out that it's really crucially depending on the fit, and if using better wave functions, they get better agreement with the known experimental results. Yeah? So again, it sounds very trivial. But if you try in practice to do it, you find that it's far from straightforward what to do. Yeah? And it's very ambiguous, finally, on how you choose your fit. And if you know what should come out, of course, you know what you should, how you should interpret your fit. But if you don't know, you may be misled by your fit. OK? So an alternative, I don't really have a name for that, is that you try to calculate the potential seen by an escaping electron. Yeah, so the remaining molecule, yeah, and then the potential seen by an electron which you take out. This is an idea by Lewis long time ago, when about 10 years ago at least, where he tried to improve on this type of molecular formulas and proposed that you should use this test charge going out of a molecule. Now it's also done, as far as I know, from by Regina de Vivier Riedle and others, who also try to use quantum chemistry calculation to get the potential and then to calculate the tunneling through this potential barrier, this suppressed, I mean field suppressed potential barrier. Yeah, so you can calculate the potential the electron has to tunnel through.
Alejandro,
yes?
You have a reference for this?
I should give you. I didn't put it here. So it's Lewis from the end of the 90s, 2000, but I can show you. And of course, Regina is rather recent.
Yes. The point here that you can boil it down to one particle potential, is that your point?
Exactly.
And then you solve it on a 3D grid? I mean, that's still expensive potential.
What you try to do is you try to get some quantum chemical calculation, and you look for the, of course, the, along the field, yeah, where the suppression is highest, and then you look in this 1D, but it's a good point, yeah? In this way, you make it 1D, and then you can do WKB or whatever you like to get the tunneling through this 1D barrier, but it's a good point. So, and the third one, as Robin already mentioned, is of course to use true static field rates. Yeah. I emphasize that those models, ADK, PPT, in its original formulation, this tunneling through the barrier is all limited formally to the tunneling regime. And in ADK, you see it, how dramatically it overshoots, actually, if you just extend it without caring into the over the barrier regime. Yeah? Because it's just a mathematical, I mean, you have a mathematical formula, and you can, of course, apply it wherever you like. And what you get out is a pure random number, not really, but somehow. So in this case, actually, it overshoots. Yeah, the tunneling formula is predicting higher rates than it should be true in the over the barrier regime. Yeah? Now, if you have a true static field rate, then of course you should have the full problem solved. And as we discussed, for atoms, you may think about, for example, stereo complex scaling to treat the core electrons and so on. Now, what has been done in the molecular case, to my knowledge, is basically, again, H2 plus by Plummer and McCann. And H2 was done by me. Parallel orientation. Yeah? Using exterior complex scaling in a rather, I would say, tricky fashion, because the trick was to use polarized spherical coordinates, and in this way I could afford to do exterior complex scaling with a zero unscaled volume. So I just leave an infinitely small ellipse around, I mean, just enclosing the two nuclei unscaled. That's the trick there. Yes? You were, or just relaxing? Sorry. No, you were making some. Yes. Okay, no problem. Okay, so this is the example for H2 as a function of internuclear separation. The full up initio, fully correlated, six-dimensional, but for parallel orientation, a static ionization rate for a field of this strength. And you see that the full result is the red and the green curve. That's a funny thing, that there are two curves, but I can explain. But this is more a general feature. But you see it goes here, up like this. And then here there are two ways to continue, and the point is that you have a field-induced avoided crossing. And therefore, depending on the dynamics of your system, how you would go over this crossing, you could either follow diabatically or adiabatically. And the avoided crossing is the one between the neutral covalently dissociating H2 into H1s plus H1s and the H plus H minus ion pair state. Yeah, and this, of course, being a dipole in the field, it's turned down, and at some point, depending on the field strength, it will hit the neutral ground state. It will lead to an avoided crossing.
I have a question.
Yes.
It's a stupid question, but I'll ask it anyway. So you have an array which is undependent.
Yes.
Now, how does, and if you were also telling me, it relates to the ionization potential that your particle sees. How is that now? How does that relate?
If you
wait. The question is not over. It's coming actually. So, okay. So that's one thing. Is it one thing? How does it relate to the fact that your particle ionizes at different points on your cycle, on your field?
There's no cycles. This is a static field.
How is it static?
This is a full static calculation.
What if I wanted to put a field?
It's a different story, but this we can discuss.
That's a difference.
So yeah? it's so to speak, the gamma static of FFT. It's not the cycle average gamma that you're plotting here?
No,
here's just the, but it doesn't matter because the cycle averaging is just a prefactor, a trivial prefactor for a sinus omega T field.
Of course, it does matter because if you had a cycle average from an H2, you would hit positions depending on the intensity of heat resonance stabilization.
That's what I'm trying to
so, of course, you will never see it if you have a static, true static field, so that's quite different.
Okay. So, this is then the comparison to the full TDSE. Yeah? So, actually, you see this is now simplified with ADK, but it's what I see, show you here is that if one considers nuclear motion in the very simplest way, which I proposed also about 10 years ago, is that you just, in the von Oppenheimer spirit, you should not take, as people usually did, the experimental ionization potential of H2 or whatever molecule you like, but you should consider the electron binding energy as a function of the internuclear geometry. In this case, it's simply as internuclear separation. If you do this simple trick to the ADK formula, you get, instead of a flat line, which people had been using before, you get the blue line. And what you see is, if you forget about the voided crossing, which of course ADK cannot know about, so if you remain in this part, especially in this part, it was actually very depressing for me at that time. I mean, I did a full correlated, six-dimensional, complex scaling calculation of H2 in a static field, and what I get out is ADK. Yeah? I mean, there's no scaling here. It's really just as it comes out without any adjusting. It's on top of each other. Yeah? This is depressing. Of course, it was also comforting, and I was lucky because I found this effect here, which ADK fortunately cannot know. Yeah? But in principle, it's really surprising how good ADK works to predict even this R dependence if you consider the R dependence in the way I was telling you, yeah, by introducing an R dependent ionization potential or binding energy. Yeah? So therefore, having this in mind and concentrating now on this part, I have on the next graph simply the comparison to ADK. And now, TDSE is the red one. ADK is the black one. ADK just multiplied by 25 for this intensity, 3.5 10 to the 13, is the blue one.
And this is again the static field ionization.
ADK is even simpler, but it was agreeing to my static field calculation.
TDSE?
No, TDSE is a full TDSE,
and the field is
a full six-dimensional TDSE calculation at 800 nanometer, 1.55 eV.
Okay. So for the TDSE, it is time dependent, right?
That's fully time dependent.
Yeah,
this is the name TDSE.
This is not the regime, but ADK is wrong.
This is what I'm telling you.
So you're way too fast.
So, what you see here is that despite Sergei's fully correct assertion that ADK is not valid, the principles is described here well. If you go to higher intensities, actually even in the lower R part will agree. And of course, the deviations you see is that you are really not in the ADK here, and so to speak, you are not really reaching the ADK limit, and this is exactly the interesting part. It's very difficult to reach a limit where ADK is absolutely quantitatively correct. Keeping this in mind with what I just said before.
What kind of pulse did you use?
Cosine square. Six cycles, 800 nanometers.
The result will depend on that, doesn't
it? We have done a plethora of calculations in the meantime. This is the oldest calculation from 4 years ago. No. The point is that, this is an important point I want to make, while ADK may be good for predicting tunneling ionization on an absolute scale, or if you use the full ab initio static rate, it doesn't matter. The quasi-static and the static on the full TDSE may not agree. Yeah? But the point is not, it's not a failure of ADK to predict the correct tunneling of H2, at least. But what it says is it's a failure of the quasi-static approximation you see here. And the fortunate or unfortunate point, as you want to call it, is that the R dependence, for example, so this change is relatively well predicted qualitatively by ADK, or if you include the binding energy scaling, or whatever model you take. while the absolute values, as I said, is a factor of 25. And the point is that this factor changes, of course, with the peak intensity you take here. So if you increase to 10 to the 14, you do not have to scale at all. They lie almost on top of each other. But if you continue, ADK will happily advance in the other direction.
I fully agree, because ADK was good at small internuclear distances in the static, and here it's terrible at small internuclear distances. So this is just...
No. The point is that you have to keep in mind... Yeah. The point is that you have to keep in mind where you in this regime are. Now, the binding energy of H2 for small internuclear separations, as you see from the ionization rate, goes down dramatically. So you are going along this line. As a consequence, if you're going too low in this scaled field, that's the point, binding energy comes in here, you may leave the tunneling into the respect to the multiphoton. And what you see is the structure is a structure due to a resonance, actually, which at 800 nanometers still is visible on these scales, for these parameters. Now, on the other side, as I said, if you go over 10 to the 14, you move happily above this barrier or this line, and you will overestimate the rate, or yield. Actually, this is ion yields for the pulse. Okay?
Is there also a reason why there's this intensity-dependent factor? I mean, you said now why you may leave the regime where this is applicable at all. But is there also clear at which point one misses this dependence?
No. In principle, of course, you can only make an guess by change looking, for example, on the hydrogen atom failure. To see in which regime here you will get which deviation. Or you do, as I said, as PPT already did, you introduce a frequency-dependent correction factor. And this cures this quite well. So this takes this factor here quite well into account.
Alejandro, at small distances you should go towards helium.
But you have the nuclear repulsion, of course. You have to take care of that,
This is... you fix the distance in this calculation. So
yes? I don't understand the point, no.
Well, if you...
The binding energy is important point.
If R becomes small,
yes?
Go towards the limiting case of helium.
For the binding energy.
The binding energy is a difference between the potential curve of H2 and H2 plus. And it's not the same like in helium. That's...
No, but if you
yes,
together,
if you read it together, yes, at some point, but this is...
So it's consistent, right?
Yeah, but this, the real thing happens, of course, it goes then very... I mean, because this now, the details here depend really on how you put your potential curves are in the steep regimes and the difference between them.
But then I'm supposed to make out of this, you say some of you said it's terrible, but the relative dependence seems to be okay with the ADK.
Yes, so what I'm saying is that if you have something where the binding energy or the ionization potential changes, like here due to the internuclear separation, because of its exponential influence on the ionization, even in a simple Landau type of equation, as long as you are not really far away from the quasi-static regime, it will be the dominant trend. Okay? So the relative change with this should be at least somehow sensible. Okay? So, now the next step would be to be more universal, so now to try to cover not just this regime or this part of the regime, but in principle to have the attempt is to have an approximation for everything. And this is the strong field approximation, or SFA, which is also called Keldysh Faisal Riesz theory, or Riesz theory, or I think it's IMST. intense field, no, ISMT. Intense field S-metric theory by Andreas Becker and Faisal. Now, here the idea is, of course, that you start with a correct S-matrix expression, but then you do some truncation of your series expansion. And in most cases, what people understand with SFA is just a truncation after the first term, which basically means that for a neutral, you ignore the influence of the Coulomb potential on the escaping electron in the final state. So the physical picture behind is that you say, as long as the electron is bound, deeply bound, it doesn't see the field. This is the initial state. As far as the electron is out and sufficiently far and driven by the field, dragged away by the field, it only sees the laser field. That's a physical picture behind, or one can put behind. But formally, of course, it comes from an S-matrix exact formulation, and you make a series expansion and truncate. Yeah? So, H of t is equal to H naught. There was a purpose to this. To H naught plus some H interaction. And as I said, then obtain infinite S matrix. Expansion and then truncate. Now, because you don't want to have the full.
Alejandro,
yes.
This means you're using kind of Volkov states for the continuum electron.
If you ignore the
atom itself.
Yes, or you take the Coulomb, or you can. This is exactly a point I want to make, but it's good that you ask. One of the problems with defining SFA is really that there are many definitions. Yeah? And it's very, very cumbersome to find your way through. I mean, the starting point is, you can see already, from the initials KFR, Keldysh, Faisal, Rice. Of course, there's a debate whether all of them should be there or not. I don't want to dwell on this. But the key point is, I mean, given by one of the authors at least, but the idea is that you can formulate now, of course, the whole problem differently using a different partitioning. So how you choose a naught and H interaction depends on your personal favor. And you can partition it even differently in initial and final channel. So you can also use post and prior form of the S-matrix theory. On top of it, you can use length or velocity gauge of your dipole operator. And as a consequence, there's a lot of confusion. Namely, first of all, people call the same thing, I mean, call different things with the same name, SFA, yeah, but do completely different things. On top of it, many people only distinguish between length gauge and velocity gauge SFA. But again, this can be extremely confusing. Actually, we have recently shown that you can start, I mean, motivated by a work by Faisal, where he has actually two papers published, one in PRA, one in JFSB, which are very interesting if you read them, because they look, I mean, first of all, they look extraordinarily similar. So first you think it's the same paper, but then you see at some point he makes a detour. In one case, he starts with length gauge and ends up with a standard SFA amplitude as you would obtain it if you start in velocity gauge. In the other paper, it's exactly the way around. He starts with velocity gauge and ends up with a formula which looks like the one we know from length gauge. The problem is that in the one paper, he writes that he has now found a universal gauge independent or gauge invariant formulation of SFA. Now, the truth to our opinion, and this we have shown, I think rather convincingly, is that it's really, you have to be careful. It depends on both partitioning and gauge. And you can demonstrate that you can use completely arbitrary gauges and always recover an S-matrix amplitude, which you know from a completely different gauge, by just choosing the partitioning properly. So in what actually turns out is that the gauge freedom gives you two parameters. The partitioning gives you two parameters with which you can specify all possible partitionings. So you have four parameters. Now, if you just fix one thing, the S-matrix amplitude, however, only depends on two parameters. So you can now choose any linear combination of the other four to recover whatever S-matrix amplitude you like. Yeah. So that's really important to understand, and I may, if somebody is interested, I can give you the reference. So problem, different formulations. Depending on gauge and partitioning. So it's in PRA 79, because I don't want to, of course, to go into the whole formalism. 0 to 3, 4 to 1, from 2009. Yeah, so it's really important that you should not mix up SFA with SFA. Yeah, unfortunately, there's a big confusion about this. And of course, the reason for this confusion is, if you truncate your S-matrix series here, you will normally be gauge-dependent. Yeah, which is okay, because you use approximate wave functions if you express it in terms of a Lippmann-Schwinger type of approach. So you expect that gauge variance can happen, or your gauge invariance is broken. But of course, this leads to a lot of debate, which is the better gauge, yeah, and arguments, I think, since before I started in this field, already a long time ago, and continuing from time to time. Yeah. Of course, the whole thing started again when the people used it for SFA for molecules. Yeah. Again, you have different gauges, different dressings of the states, etc. Okay?
Alejandro,
yes?
Going back to Anatoly's question. There still the final state is a Volkov state, right?
Usually it's a Volkov state, yeah. In the usual case, you take a Volkov state, yes.
One more request. Can you make briefly ADK and SFA on this plot?
So
just shade the area approximately.
Oh. You
should be looking.
No, this I cannot. Now, the point is that, as I said, ADK I would expect to be living somewhere in this area. Now, SFA depends on whom you ask. If you ask an SFA maniac, he will tell you it covers everything. Yeah? Okay. Do we want to have a democratic vote here?
Well,
as I said, as long as you do not truncate, yeah? Now, of course, if you, for example, want to consider not just ionization, but also the recollision, you need already to go beyond the first term. Yeah? So, of course, it depends now what you are doing. And the other thing is now, which is very important, is your definition of what is working. Again, like here. As we saw, it's qualitatively it may describe some things, but quantitatively it's far away. Now in SFA, it's a very similar thing. Actually, which people normally forget to say, is if you use SFA with a Volkov state straightforwardly, your result in velocity gauge will be typically 2 to 3 orders of magnitude off the correct value. If you do length gauge, it's typically 1 to 2 orders of magnitude off the correct value. But, like here, you can define this Coulomb correction term, a simple prefactor, which brings you, of course, like here, the magic 25, which brings you on a good shape. Yes. Or do alpha, I think, was
to
first.
To add to the variety of problems you can get, I'd like to mention that in the late 80s, there were some experiments by Buxbaum, actually, on the elliptically polarized light.
Yes.
And there you get a break of the four-fold asymmetry, and ADK and KFR completely missed that. Mm. Which is due to the final state.
Yes. Sorry.
Which is in perturbation theory, by the way.
Yes.
And the statement was made that the non-perturbative theories would need to introduce a correction to capture the result of perturbation theory.
This sounds some of the referee reports I get, what we have to do with the TDSE.
There is also a difference between ADK like theories and the SFA, is that SFA, it's based on the S matrix and there is no time dependence. While for the ADK, you can integrate over the pulse shape.
No, but SFA, you can formulate time dependently.
The S matrix, you know, it's...
It may be unpleasant, but I mean, this is a problem with the arguments you can have.
It's defined properly for infinite times.
Yes.
Just for... Yes. I'm not an expert on ADK or SFA or other letters, but I would like to know...
You know the ABC.
Tested. Are we talking about H atom only, H2? I mean... I know quite many molecules.
Yes.
So I'm afraid. I have an idea of what we are talking about. Yes. I start to feel a bit uneasy if you say good or bad, and
good or bad, good
only,
or bad, good or bad, tested,
and H2 for some distances. So
you are exactly making the point. Yes. We don't know.
Only about
We have some calculations, of course, for a little bit larger molecules, and there are some like nitrogen, oxygen, and so on. And if you again. If you follow the comparison to the experiment, which has been done by, for example, Andreas Becker, it works very, very great. Yeah? If you put them on the same scale, because the experiment is relative. So the problem occurs if you can look more accurately, and if not, for example, there's a lot of averaging or the experimental uncertainties with the peak intensity, etc. So in the full TDSE type of comparison, it's just starting. Yes?
So just to comment, I mean, in a sense, experimentalists have done a lot of ADK tests, if
yes.
you want. ADK fits for ion yields on atoms much more mm-hmm. complicated than hydrogen. I mean,
yes.
and especially going to even relatively high charge states. I mean, the ADK curves are normally not that far away. Right, they normally shift them a little bit to match the experiment, but again, all these shapes normally come out right, and I think that's more or less also how the famous need for non-sequential double ionization was seen.
Yes.
By seeing basically a noticeable deviation from ADK.
Yes. But this is what I'm trying to say. What you really need is well-defined structures to appear on a logarithmic scale. Because the problem is really that, I mean, I agree fully to this, but I would remind you that also until almost 2000, people were convinced from the experimental side that a molecule ionizes exactly like an atom with the same ionization potential. Yeah? So much to the accuracy of these comparisons. Yeah? But I know this. I mean, of course, as I said, when I did the full TDSE for helium comparing with the Max Born people, they were always saying, yeah, but it's not agreeing to ADK. Yes, it's not. I'm sorry. Yeah, okay. So then, the idea, however, of this is, as I said, it's in principle, you start with the full theory, but then you do a strong truncation. And the question is, what are you, so to speak, sacrificing if you do so? And now...
Alejandro, this is for one electron. Now, that's what we are talking about, right? One electron.
This is first to start with one electron, but you can extend it, of course, in a single active electron. I will come to this approximation to this. To molecules or larger atoms. But in principle, of course, the theory you can formulate fully. Yeah, you can put in wave functions as you like. And then get out what you want. Yeah, and you can do further approximations like you did already to incorporate that. And the question is, what is the larger approximation you do? Now, just to tell you that also the strong field approximation may not be simple to calculate, I give you here a result of Deja and Milosevic. First of all, to show you different variants of the SFA. So this is all for oxygen, four types of what he claims is SFA. Velocity gauge, length gauge, so length gauge, velocity gauge, and some dressed and some undressed states pictures, which he also proposed, which he thinks is for molecule more appropriate. So this is the orientation-dependent ionization of oxygen. So when the laser field, the linear polarized laser field, scans through the, through the angle. I mean, this is the molecule, and then you scan like this, Then the probability for ionization peaks in oxygen here somewhere. But as you see, it may depend on your model. But even worse for nitrogen, you see, you have a democratic vote that it should be parallel or antiparallel, which is easier to ionize. Now, just to make the point here, it's of course a rather funny situation that in the meantime, as far as I know, there have been four groups calculating velocity gauge SFA of nitrogen. Now, two groups agree that the result looks like this. Two groups agree that the result looks like this. And it's a stupid debate because evidently they all claim to do the same thing, velocity gauge, SFA, but it just shows you that the calculation, the model you take for your molecule, whatever, is not so trivial like the harmless equation may look like.
I have another question. This is the first ionization.
Yes.
So what about systems where you have many ionizations close by?
This is the peanut butter part. You know, no, I mean, you can do it sequentially, of course, you can do it step by step with all these methods. But non-sequentially, of course, it would be a different story. So, now you wanted to have some comparisons. Of course, I cannot give you sensible comparisons for fullerene or whatever you like, or DNA. So, this is now what we can do, H2. So this is now the comparison of a time-dependent Schrödinger equation, black, with MOADK. So you see, of course, if you are here, and this may be quite well in the tunneling part, which however is very small, as you see in the intensity window, you have to be very careful to find it. But otherwise, I mean, this is a logarithmic scale again, from 10 to the minus 12 to 1. There's a strong deviation in the slope and the intensity dependence. Okay? Okay. Forget about it here. But no, it's a DFT model we use for describing the core, a frozen core in this calculation.
That core stands for von Willebrand invariant.
Exactly.
Which is the form of exchange correlation potential.
Correct, Coulombic.
Coulombic.
Yes. Okay, I didn't want to be so detailed, but yes. Thank you. And this is a comparison between this and a Hartree-Fock frozen core, and you see the difference is not really a big compared to the difference to the full calculation.
There is no adjustment here. You just
This is just numbers as is for this 800 nanometer 12 cycle pulse. Okay. Now this is comparison again with the TDSE, the black one. Now with strong field approximation, with velocity gauge or length gauge, velocity gauge or length gauge. And you see the shape is quite okay. And what you hear, the VC and the BC is different Coulomb corrections. So the Becker correction, as we called it, Becker-Faisal in principle, the paper Andreas Becker, where he actually introduces it empirically, phenomenologically, when you compare to all the other experiments. The VC is, so to speak, what we got when we adjust the correct, or we assume that SFA and velocity gauge should converge to the tunneling limit. And we derived an analytical formula for this limit. And then we can correct, so to speak, by enforcing this, we get a prefactor, and which we just use for 800 nanometers. Whether it's sensible or not, we don't want to discuss, but this is just the way to do it. Yeah? And OK, so this is what you get. In a length gauge, this is the result. There's no Coulomb correction we have adapted here. Yeah? So, but I emphasize, these Coulomb corrections are here a factor of 100. Yeah? So if you thought ADK with a factor 25 was bad, here you are even worse. Despite the fact that you have a seemingly or as apparently very sophisticated approach. Okay? Now,
can I ask a question two years back? I'm sorry.
Yes.
I'm always a little back. On these angular distributions from O2 and N2, which are different, presumably all B is something
yes.
different.
And length gauge, velocity gauge, dressed and undressed intermediate state, final or initial state, sorry.
Okay, but where these are monochromatic electrons coming out of? They're coming from some.
No, this is just the total, the integrated total yield.
Okay.
So it's the total number of ions produced or total number of electrons produced if single ionization happens only as a function of the orientation.
Energy to pump everybody out there. Is that
no.
Strong
field? No, no.
So K electrons are coming out.
No, 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 no. We are just looking on one electron here, basically going out.
Yeah, I know, but what is it? It's starting out in some orbital? Or?
In the valence. It's a valence electron.
Yeah, but there are three valence.
It's the first one which goes out.
Just the outer, yeah?
The outer one.
The outer
one.
Okay. Well, then there should
yeah?
be
because this is always the idea in this long wavelength fields that the first one which should go out is this. Okay. This one.
So it's dominated by the first ATIP.
Yes. So. Now, I'll skip this. And D, is Floki. So the Floki approach would be you take again an in principle infinite perturbation, periodic, and you can again argue that you can use the same trick as you know from solid state physics from the Bloch wave function that you use this periodicity to get to a Floki type Hamiltonian with a wave function with the quasi periodic structure, and you get quasi energies with a width which correspond to the ionization rate. Yeah. So compared to solid state physics, so you use the Floki or Bloch theorem for this periodic perturbation, and you get, as I said, quasi-energy states and with width. So it's kind of every state turns in the field into an auto-ionizing state because there's a finite lifetime of the state because it can tunnel out it, even with a very small number, but it should always be possible in an infinite perturbation, long perturbation, to tunnel out. Yeah. So. So you get quasi-energies plus widths. And they are correlated to decay rates. Again, of course, beyond hydrogen atom, and even there, it's a non-trivial calculation. But in principle, it's a very fancy one, and with complex scaling again, you can, of course, have a good way, or neat way, to consider auto-ionizing or pseudo-auto-ionizing types of states. Yeah. So, but again, beyond hydrogen atom in some effective one electron models, it's very difficult to do. But you can do this with R metrics, there are some attempts, etc., in some calculations for alkalis, etc.
Well, that actually reminds me, have there been lots of studies on one electron atoms which don't have a Coulombic potential, so you get
alkalis.
Degeneracy?
Yeah, alkalis have been studied. But of course not in the full glory, typically. Yeah.
Those quasi ends up changing the intensity of the field.
Yes, and the frequency, of course. I mean, we will have, of course, the, yeah. In principle, I mean, the nice thing with Floquet is, of course, that you get these very simple physical pictures, what happens if you, for example, have avoided crossings, yeah, and then you have decay rates due to some two states which are crossing by the laser field, yeah. So if you, for example, take a molecular potential curve like this, yeah, then, or say, you can do it like this, yeah, for H2 or H2 plus, say, yeah, and then you say, okay, you shift, so to speak, one relative to the other by one photon energy, and you get a new state in first approximation, and then you see that dissociation in this case could happen here due to this photon-induced avoided crossing. So this is a nice feature, but of course it gets horrendously unpleasant if you are approaching this regime, yeah. And you don't see too much any longer if you have many, many photons and a continuum of states, so to speak, close by. Yes?
Yeah, I remember some papers along these lines by Shakeshaft.
Yes.
And I remember they went into incredible complexity in the complex plane and analytic continuation. What was all that about? Why did they need to do all that?
Because the idea was really to have this very good or insight into the physics, to try to analyze the states. So one thing is just to get a number. Actually, there's a code available by Potfleisch on the net, in the net. So I can only recommend it if somebody wants to do some calculation on one electron, of course, problems. And so this is doable. But the point is simply that the analysis gets cumbersome if you have too many avoided crosses.
But to really calculate the spectrum, it's yes. Much simpler than all that continuation stuff.
Okay. Exactly. Yeah. And of course, in that time, I mean, when they started, really, computers were slightly different from what we have today. We shouldn't forget about that. Yeah, so it was quite a different effort.
This work is not, not adapted to the modern days.
As I said, there's this one electron code. It's freely available in principle, or relatively free, I think, over the QCP, or the Journal of Computational Physics, or whatever. Or a computer, now how is it called? Computer?
Communication.
Yeah, exactly, sorry. Well, thank you. Okay. So this is, this can be done, and is very helpful or interesting. And but again, has not been done really for molecules beyond H2 plus, to my knowledge. Yeah.
Just a comment. In principle, Floquet is nice, but there's the assumption, as you say, it has to be quasi-periodic.
Yes.
In other words, when you're talking about
an ultra-short pulse, it doesn't make sense.
A two-cycle pulse.
Yes.
Floquet is not ideal. For
yes. Although I remind on there's a very nice paper by Holthaus on how to consider non-infinite pulses or perturbations in Floquet theory, which I really recommend. It's a really nice paper.
How's that spelled?
Holthaus.
How's that spelled? Chu has some papers too.
Sorry?
General, Shi Chu also has.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. Yeah. No, here I think it's a very nice way of treating finite pulses. I don't remember if Shu has something on it. He has also? Okay, maybe. Sorry.
The way,
then,
in fact,
not forgetting this.
It has been, there were several works on this question, and it, it turns out that the validity range of the Floquet approach, one electron and so on, is for short pulses, is surprising. It works surprisingly good. Well, I am sure. Another point on Floquet, I just want to get. You introduced the Floquet picture through solid state But you should know.
Yes, this is what I said.
Floquet work was.
This is why I
on time dependent Hamiltonian.
Yes.
Not at all time specially periodic. It's really something time dependent.
I mean, this is why I try to emphasize Floquet here in front. But I'm sorry. Yeah. But I mean, normally people are more familiar with the Bloch concept.
Well, but the Floquet theorem is for
I know.
Periodic Hamiltonian.
Yes, I know.
And in classical mechanics, by the way.
Yes, I fully agree. This is why I put it first. Okay, so now finally. You have the full solution of the time-dependent Schrödinger equation, TDSE. So you just, in parentheses, solve E h bar d by d t c h c, in parentheses, just solve it. And I just remind that, like with the Floquet, of course one should be careful with saying this is the exact full solution, because we do not normally consider the surrounding, the environment, the spontaneous processes. Yeah. So spontaneous emission should not play an important role here, except, of course, you really do the full thing with the environment. Yeah. Then, of course, you would have, again, the TDSE would be fine, as you know. So it is, in principle, of course, in this way, formulated in this way, it's only valid as long as a wave function approach is suitable. Yeah, sorry, this is appropriate, not suitable. Suitable is maybe always, but appropriate. Okay. So now coming back to the comparisons. So this is now again hydrogen atom, where we can really do brute force everything. So 800 nanometer laser field, and this is a laser peak intensity between 10 to the 13 and 10 to the 14, I mean a little bit going beyond or lower. And what you see here now is a lot of curves, a lot of chaos. I don't know whether you see anything, but okay. So the Floquet calculation, using a slightly modified version of Potvlich's program, I mean, if you give Julian Wanne something like this, he will always optimize it. But okay, and make it even faster. So this is the black line, the full Floquet. Now the TDSE is the purple dots. Yeah, you see, we would need a much finer grid to resolve this, if at all. But of course, you need also a very long pulse to resolve it, which we don't want to do the TDSE for. And now you have the original length gauge SFA and the original velocity gauge SFA. This is a scale from 10 to the minus 12 to 10 to the minus 3. Sorry? That's a good question. This was, I think, this is rates, sorry. Yeah. So this was a calculation where Julian really did TDSE calculations as a function of the pulse duration with a Gaussian turn on flat top, Gaussian turn off, to get a rate. So he did so long that the yield was linear and he could extract a rate. So these points are really heavy calculations. This is not one TDSE, it's a full converged set to get a rate from the TDSE calculations. Yeah? Okay. So, and you see what Alfred already asserted, fully correctly, that at least the rates are perfect, but of course, even in turn, if you go back, it's really surprising that you can get a rate if there are no resonances about with 5, 6, 10 cycles. Yeah? So, again, it's very important what you mean by Arshot. Yeah, of course, 10 cycles of an X-ray laser, something completely different than 10 cycles of an 800 nanometer laser. Yeah, but it's surprising how fast it settles. Of course, not these structures. But you shouldn't forget that these structures you will barely see in an experiment because of the resolution, etc. Yeah, so they will be averaged out anyhow. But I remind you now that, yeah, bare SFA is far away from the full calculation. But if you use a Coulomb correction, yeah, then you may get here, and you may get a reasonable description of the problem. Yeah.
If I see where, so the Coulomb correction doesn't change anything except the magnitude.
Basically.
Basically.
The point is that the Coulomb correction of Andreas Becker is omega independent, which we claim is one of the problems. And the reason is simple. As I said, he compared to a lot of experiments, but the experiments were always done with one laser. So although he compared to results from the Titan Sapphire or neodymium yak or even a CO2 laser, he always had one consistent set where he had to upscale. And therefore, he didn't see the omega dependence. Yes?
Could you say something on the structure of the ionization curve? I mean, what's the physical reason for all the structure and peaks or this minimum and maximum?
Resonances. So this is Rampe peaks, basically. And of course, on top of it, you have some channel closing. But they are very, I mean, difficult to see, like here. Yeah. But basically, it's intermediate resonances, which in an infinite pulse with an extremely high resolution, you would resolve. But it's very hard to see them in practice. Even at 800 nanometers, this is why I emphasized what I said in the beginning. Don't believe that here is a magic border. Don't believe if you go from here, from this point to this point, your whole structure will be gone and you will have an exponential decay. Of course not. It's a slow transition, and the resonances just get less and less important. It may, in a better experiment, not, or in a state-of-the-art but still not very high really resolved experiment, not be resolved. Yeah. So there is channel closings in the SFA, but no resonances. Yeah?
Why is this in the SFA also destructive?
Hmm?
This is a channel closing.
A little more detailed channel closing. I think I know what you mean, but
okay.
I'd like to hear your precise statement of it.
Cool. The channel closing for me is basically the like Peter said, that if you say need four photons to reach from some initial state to the continuum, then due to the ponderal motive shift or the AC Stark shift, as a function of intensity, it may now change like this, and as a consequence, you would need five photons to ionize instead of four. Yeah. So suddenly, your ionization drops as a function, or do you have a higher intensity because you suddenly need a higher order process?
So both the ponderal motive shift and the AC Stark are quadratic in the field, and for the low field region.
Yes.
So why is it sloping like that?
I just sketched the process, sorry.
Well, that's intensity. But,
yes, and it's intensity, sorry, yeah. Yeah.
So it is quadratic in the field.
Yeah, sorry, yeah. So the field would be quadratic.
Right, but I mean the AC Stark shift.
Yeah, but the reversibilities are different.
Yes.
So you still get a spool.
Oh, there's a difference.
I mean the basic effect in strong field is of course that you need to bring the electron in the continuum. Yeah, in the continuum which is now not flat but it contains the laser field. So you have to give it this energy. Yeah. Or provide this energy.
Can I add something?
Yes, of course.
The ponderal motive shift is one thing, and it will show that the channel closes and so on. But the AC Stark shifts of states, so you have three photons there, which can be near resonance. This shifts the manifold of states. So this would severely affect the power dependence in addition to the ponderal motion.
Yes. So of course you have the shifts of the bound state, but they are much smaller. So they will come on to play only later on. Alfred, you wanted also?
knowledge was just that.
Okay.
The shift of the bounds of the ground state is small, and it goes down a little bit in a low frequency field, but it remains small.
Okay. So, what is state of the art now in TDSE? State of the art in the TDSE, because I was already asked that there are some other molecules could be. Now, unfortunately, the full TDSE for a real molecule has not been achieved. So what has been achieved basically in the TDSE, unfortunately I don't have the time, but okay, you can just sketch it, is of course you can do H2 plus, the one electron with fixed nuclei. You can have some moving nuclei. You have H2 with if you have 800 nanometers with two with fixed nuclei. If you go to 2, 3, 4 photon, maybe 5 photon in the moment, by Fernando Martin, you can include nuclear motion for the parallel orientation, which saves you one dimension in the electrons. So this is now the full H2, I would say, the most we can do in the moment, at least we definitely can do in the moment, is, yeah, this is a full H2, full six-dimensional TDSE calculation for perpendicular orientation, so it's really 6D, so you need the full dimensionality. It's not just parallel. 800 nanometers, and every point here is one full TDSE calculation for these different intensities. And just should say we are not using a supercomputer for that. I want to emphasize this. Yeah? And the reason we can do it is that we use a spectral expansion in a CI configuration interaction basis of H2 using a special designed prodate spheroidal coordinate code with B splines for the H2 plus, and then we expand the H2 plus wave function we use for the H2. So this is one way where we can do two electrons fully. We can also do electron energy resolved spectra. We can also do high harmonics. And what we also can do now, and Sergei will probably go for his way of doing it, and there's a third one, is of course the single active electron approximation. This is the channels, channel closing, or resonances. But here it's the channel closing, for example, you see here, yeah, which moves with intensity.
Andrew, the other group is out
there
waiting.
Okay. Then, as I said, I want to stop here anyhow.